You're listening to Jaipur Bites. I'm your host, Lakshdatta. This episode is a session from day two of Jaipur Lit Fest 2023, and it's called Phantom Plague: How Tuberculosis Shaped History. Vidya Krishnan in conversation with Ambarish Satwik.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, comrades and friends, enthusiastic pathology tourists. I thank you all for coming for this highly morbid session on repulsive, sometimes death-dealing infectious disease, tuberculosis, on a sparklingly fine Jaipur morning when you've got more attractive concurrent sessions underway. Let me give you a kind of whistle-stop tour on tuberculosis in India to begin with. There's one Indian dying of tuberculosis every minute. One-fifth of the global burden of tuberculosis is in India. It's the leading cause of death in people living with HIV. Almost a third of the deaths in HIV disease are attributable to tuberculosis, and it's one of the top five killers of Indian women in their reproductive prime. Now, those may be cold and abstract statistics, but I think it's our mandate today to make you queasily aware of the kind of schadenfreude that exists about tuberculosis in this country. We tend to believe that the horrors of tuberculosis are so bleak that people like us will not get it. Ipso facto, people not like us will get it. I think the vanity of that illusion has to be broken, has to be shattered, because you know, if film stars and celebrities and heads of state can get tuberculosis, so can you. If Amitabh Bachchan can get tuberculosis, so can you. It doesn't require a vector like a mosquito or a bug. It doesn't require sexual intimacy. It's airborne. And frankly, if you think that the BCG vaccine that you have in your arm is giving you some kind of protection against infection, it's not happening. If vaccines were modes of transportation, if the measles vaccine was the Lamborghini, the BCG is like a wheelbarrow. So that's not happening. We are here to celebrate the release of the book Phantom Plague, How Tuberculosis Shaped History. And this is an absolutely stellar social history of tuberculosis by the award-winning investigative journalist Vidya Krishnan. Ms. Krishnan charts the arc from 19th century vampire panics in New England to the Warrens of Dharavi. And I'll set into motion by asking Ms. Krishnan, why is tuberculosis the phantom plague?
That's a searching question. I use that to mean multiple things in the book. Firstly, when the HIV epidemic happened in the 90s, that's when there was this realization that TB is a really big problem. And TB has somehow been a sidekick to all these sexy new viruses that come from time to time, and we now have that with COVID. And India's entire tuberculosis program has been COVIDized down to the health ministry's helpline. And we were talking about it earlier that at these sessions when I talk about the book, so often I have people who come up to me much later and say my grandmother had it or my mother had it. And there is so much there is almost an intimacy when you share someone in your life has TB as against other diseases, where there is almost a performance of wanting comfort from outsiders. Like, you know, we talk about depression and abortion and cardiac problems, and you tell people you love that comfort me and bring me food or hold my hand as I sit through chemotherapy. Whereas you have an entire cohort of patients who've just been invisibilized, not just by the people around them, but also by the system. So we have these great myths about TB. I say that it's everywhere. There are three myths about TB: that it affects the poor, it affects one organ, which is the lungs, and it's curable. At this point, all three are so dangerously wrong that they feed the cycle of infection that we are in. As you said, no amount of caste or gender or wealth can save you from an airborne respiratory disease, which we now know from COVID. When I was working on this book much before the pandemic, most of the people were like, all the questions would be like, why are you writing about TB? And to me, it was just insane that here's a disease that has shaped our lives. It has inspired art and culture and, you know, operatic tragedies. Few people know that Moulin Rouge was TB is such a consistent character in all of these great works of literature without ever being the protagonist. And that's what, if anything, I'm for the underdog. So here I wanted to shine the spotlight on how TB has always been the sidekick to some other terrifying thing without ever getting the kind of attention it needs from WHO, but also from many other social but also political points where it kind of needs intersection. And that's actually what I hope my book, it's a conversation I hope my book forces.
Well, a lot of these myths come from popular culture, and I remember there was a time in India when tuberculosis was the cinematic illness of choice. I mean, in the days when I was growing up or earlier. And I don't know if there were a species called casting directors, but the tubercular part in Indian cinema was snapped up by Nirupa Roy. And some of the characters that were scripted for her were such that she had the limitless capacity of losing her children in her afflicted state, you know? It happened in film after film. And the trouble was that not a lot of people know this, but she was Gujarati. There was this well-fed, if you will forgive the mirth, and well-built Gujarati woman hardly looked physically tubercular. So how represented reality suffered in Indian cinema because of Nirupa Roy being the tubercular part should be a legitimate axis of inquiry. But anyway, you mentioned Moulin Rouge. There's a lot of literature where consumption was considered a fashionable disease in Victorian times. And tell us something about that.
I have this joke that I keep talking about, that consumption was this romantic malady. And, you know, there's a painting, Monet painted his wife dying of tuberculosis. And we get this gaunt-looking, you know, idea of what beauty is from tuberculosis. And, you know, it was called the white plague because you get paler and sicker and gaunter like a model for some, you know, fashion magazine. And all of that comes from tuberculosis. And for me, when I spent my time researching this book, I realized all of this is a matter of relative to other diseases. So the plague of our time, say, is COVID or HIV or tuberculosis, I would argue. But in the time when tuberculosis was considered a romantic malady, the other big killer was cholera. That's a bad way to go. I mean, you are just shitting yourself to death. And I feel like, because when you compare cholera to TB, TB just looked like a romantic malady, and it also had a string of writers and poets, and you know, it went after the Bronte sisters, each one of them. And there were so many, and there was all of this myth building about TB that you were almost intelligent. There is this paragraph which I have in the book from I forget where I quoted from, but that book says that you are almost purified by the disease because tuberculosis kills it, and that's only because cholera was the other big thing going around. I do feel that when, after the germ theory was accepted and this idea of germs infiltrated the Western imagination before it came to India, I feel as a part of the colonial, you know, the medical mission to expand colonialism. And before all of that changed, tuberculosis was said to be hereditary and run in families. And I find all of that fascinating, which is why when I still remember sitting in my newsroom at the Hindu and coming across this medical paper in the New England Journal of Medicine about vampire panics, and it was my open sesame for the book, because it's just completely mental that there is this disease, and we as we are so scared of this pathogen that instead of thinking of the most obvious thing, that this is contaminating each one in the family and killing us, we rationalize it by saying that the dead person is crawling out of the grave and sucking on the person they love the most, and there is a vampire panic that's born, and of course then we have Bram Stoker who comes up with Dracula, and how tuberculosis, it was just, I still remain completely fascinated by how how tuberculosis can capture someone's mind with fear and just inspire so much literature from it.
Yeah, I mean, when we were medical students, I came across this sentence by one of the Bronte sisters, Charlotte, I think, that consumption is a flattering malady, and it made no sense to people on the subcontinent. I mean, the fact that a disease that causes cadaverous wasting and hacking, violent cough and incessant diarrhea and constant fever and causes you to expectorate blood can be considered fashionable and flattering made no sense. It was absurd. So Vidya has, this is, it's not just a fantastic work of historical narration, but also reportage, and she's been working on these stories for many years now. And the grave thing about tuberculosis, is, as she pointed out, was that the preeminent form is pulmonary. It involves the lungs and it turns your lungs to sludge. But these little wrigglers can get into any organ that you might care to name. It could be the spleen, the liver, the intestines, the uterus, the other pelvic organs, brain, spine, lymph nodes. In fact, as medical students will testify, if you have matted lymph nodes in the neck for long that are not going away, you would almost always have to consider this as tuberculosis. What's happening is that this bacterium is gaining resistance to the drugs we have at a stupefying rate. And perhaps the epicenter of this is in Mumbai. So why don't you tell us about some of your work in Mumbai reporting on drug-resistant tuberculosis and some of the stories you encountered there?
So the first part of the book is mostly pop culture, so there's Sherlock Holmes and Dracula. But the second part is based in Mumbai, which is what South Africa, KwaZulu-Natal and South Africa was to the HIV crisis. The only difference is people in South Africa knew they were the epicenter of the crisis, as against in Mumbai, where we have a situation where the urban housing crisis in Mumbai has created living conditions which make the city a petri dish for pathogens to just thrive and springboard out of it. And COVID, of course, has taught us all of that, about how that happens when you're, you know, tightly packed in ghettos. What's happening in Mumbai, I did a lot of my reporting in Govandi, in Chembur, which is Mumbai East. And within Mumbai, Mumbai East is where most of the population lives, in these vertical slums, which came up in the 90s as the Indian government's response to better housing, which was a free market solution, where they raised all the slum clusters and built vertical slums to rehabilitate. But what that did is, these were really tiny houses with no ventilation, no municipal services, no garbage, no no schools, no parks, just it's a doctor working there called it Nazi ghetto. And this is happening in every mega city in the world, but it's specifically happening in every mega city in the global south, particularly in India, where we sentence lower caste, poor people to living conditions which are so subpar. And you were talking about how Amitabh Bachchan had spinal TB when he was filming the first season of Kaun Banega Crorepati. And there's no escaping it. Our lift operator or our cabbie, they all live in these places. And Mumbai is a city inherently built on people mixing. And I was reporting in this particular building in Chembur, which had 51 patients in one building. All of them had drug-resistant tuberculosis. And this is disturbing. It would be equal to 51 patients with a rare cancer in one building. And that is par for the course in Mumbai. And as you said, Mumbai is the hottest of hotspots for drug-resistant TB. And this bacteria is just a master mutator. It is not responding to the most powerful antibiotics we know. And it also doesn't help that the most powerful antibiotics we know are in patent monopolies. So it's error piled on error piled on error. And it's terrifying to see what's happening. But mostly for me, it's terrifying that no one in Mumbai seems to know what this is happening. So the whole year that I was reporting there, I was living in Bandra and Colaba, but I was reporting in these ghettos. And I was there through Diwali and Eid. And a bunch of my friends work in Bollywood, and they are upper caste rich people, upwardly mobile, who travel. And they would come up to me at these parties, you know, on Diwali or Eid, and they would quietly be like, my grandmother had TB, or my father's still recovering from it. And it always shocks me how little conversation we have as a society, because of the stigma that we have built. And that again is a, there's a portion of the book that goes into how caste impacts public health. And tuberculosis, more than anything else, is about collective destiny. And that's where, you know, I keep saying that tuberculosis is a symptom, poverty is a disease, and how we treat urban poor in India is actually the crisis. Until we address that, there is no addressing TB or COVID or HIV, but a bunch of public health nightmares that we are witnessing. All of it, we are seeing. I keep saying none of this is either dramatic or controversial. What we are seeing is a dawn of the post-antibiotic era, and that's what's happening in Mumbai.
I think all of us should be concerned and alarmed about drug resistance that microbes are picking up. One of your heroes in the book, Dr. Zarir Udvardia, who's a well-known physician in Mumbai, has this popular chestnut on treating tuberculosis. He says that it takes 2.1 errors to convert a drug-sensitive case of tuberculosis into a drug-resistant tuberculosis. Just 2.1 errors, which means either giving the wrong drug or giving a wrong combination or giving a wrong dose. And he has this famous paper published on this where, as we've established, that Dharavi in Mumbai is the epicenter. There are about 106 practitioners, private practitioners in Dharavi, medical practitioners. He gathered them and he gave them a questionnaire about what is the standard prescription you'll write for a 50 kilogram individual diagnosed for the first time with pulmonary tuberculosis. And out of these 106 practitioners, just six of them were able to prescribe, give out the correct prescription. 100 of them were prescribing the wrong thing. So think about it. Let me tell you, this is across the board. Don't think that a suited physician in a posh clinic is going to do anything differently. You'd be surprised to know that perhaps the strongest antibiotic, not just tuberculosis, the strongest antibiotic that we have in our midst for drug-resistant gram-negative infections in our ICUs is something called colistin. And colistin is given as animal feed to farmed animals for growth promotion. And resultantly, almost 57% of Klebsiella and gram-negative bacilli in India are resistant to the strongest drug we have against colistin. So of course, all of us must be concerned about this. But what's more important is that if you do get infected with tuberculosis, you cannot choose the variant that is infecting you. And God forbid if you get the drug-resistant variant, all the controls are with the government. Tell us something about that.
Yeah, thank you for that question. With the Indian government, I will start off saying that the tuberculosis treatment invariably is better at a government hospital than it is at a private hospital. But then we have a situation where government hospital, Dr. Udvadia says this, that the government hospital treats you for free, but it's the kind of free you cannot afford. So at a government hospital, you are treated without dignity. You are treated without safety. At your most vulnerable, you are in front of a doctor who treats you like a disease and not as a person. That's the problem at the government sector. Then comes the private hospital. The private sector, I'm sorry to say, you are a part of the private sector. The private doctors, we have an army of private doctors who at this stage are amplifying our tuberculosis crisis because they are incentivized to keep the patient and just squeeze them for their insurance as against referring them. The book talks about the study that you mentioned, and instead of referring them, it was so shocking to me that most doctors in India cannot identify or cannot diagnose a TB patient, and what you cannot diagnose, you cannot treat. So they keep treating patients with this cocktail of antibiotics, and most of the patients that I have met over the years were drug sensitive before they began, and they went through this journey of private sector doctors sending them from here to there to, you know, your neighborhood mom and pop clinic. And over months, you're progressively getting worse. And before you end at a government facility, you have drug-resistant TB. So this is a situation that that the government is actively... It's really concerning. It's exactly like COVID, actually, where you need treatment free at the point of care. But what we have in India as a TB policy is that the TB patient bears the burden on top of the stigma of being an infectious disease carrier. It falls on you to prove you have to qualify for treatment. And we have a kind of policy which gives you the best medicine when you're an inch from death, which is if you are drug resistant TB, you have to be pre-XDR to get bedaquiline or delaminate. And those drugs are also not available. And then there is a really big, to me, this is a moral crisis. I've reported a lot over the past 3 years on COVID. And this is what everything that I was writing about TB over the last 7 years came to pass in the 3 years when I was reporting on COVID. And we had a situation, particularly in India, which had a devastating second wave. I was in Boston at the time, and again, I joke about how rest of the world had like a 21st century pandemic. In India, we had a 14th century pandemic with bodies floating in Ganga, and everything from the hospital to the crematorium to wood for, you know, we ran out of everything as a society. And this is not a country which lacks good doctors. This is not like a back of beyond resource. Of course, we are resource poor in certain places. But the second wave was the first time we had like rich upper caste people in Delhi, you know, clutching their pearls and being very horrified about how bad the health system is. But this is what we pay for. This is what we've created. This is a system we built, one taxpayer-funded brick at a time over decades. And I keep talking about how what COVID has done, for the first time I am optimistic. There is a lot more attention on infectious diseases, but there is also a lot more attention on the right to health. It's a business between me and my government, which cannot be outsourced to a private for-profit entity, expecting them to do the right thing. This is a moral crisis at the end of it, and I really hope these conversations, like even last Jaipur Lit Fest, I would not expect a conversation like this or a book like this to be showcased at a place like this. And things are changing. I wonder if you feel optimistic.
No, of course. I mean, but also the infrastructure has changed due to COVID, because suddenly one must realize that one of the ways of diagnosing tuberculosis is by a nucleic acid amplification test, which was precisely the kind of platform that was used for diagnosing COVID. So suddenly you had numerous laboratories that were accredited with this platform. So it has made a difference. But you're right. I think I don't think any national tuberculosis program can run without public money. And it has to be accountable.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Jaipur Bites. I'm your host, Laksh Datta. This podcast is produced by Lonchora in association with Teamwork Arts. Please follow or subscribe to this show wherever you're listening to this to be notified about new episodes.